Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 15 years ago, the groundbreaking book, The Rise of the Creative Class by urban studies theorist Richard Florida, encouraged leaders of cities large and small across the United States to reimagine the possibilities. And they did. They worked to attract artists, innovators, and entrepreneurs. And lo and behold, many cities started to turn around. But nothing happens in a vacuum. Now head of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, Richard Florida has returned with a new book about the fallout from that turnaround. It's entitled The New Urban Crisis: How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
When during the, after, you know, I guess when did you become aware that things were going south in the cities, but not maybe in a noticeable way?
You know, I think I knew it even when I was writing Rise of the Creative Class. And one of the things I mentioned in the new book is that when I was writing that book, I actually took a look at inequality and its relationship to creative and knowledge-driven and innovative cities. And my editor, the book was already 150,000 words, and he said, save that for another book. I then published that essay in early 2003, right on the heels of Rise of the Creative Class. And that essay in the Washington Monthly, which folks could look up if they want, it's online, really showed that these highly innovative and creative places like San Francisco or Silicon Valley or Boston or Seattle, in some ways, many ways, Columbus represents this too, mm-hmm. had high levels of inequality. But I don't think it really dawned on me what that meant, if folks understand. I think I saw in a relationship, an association. I think what really happened is this back to the city movement, and you can see it, you know, in Columbus, you can see it in Boston, you can see it in Seattle. It really happened after the year 2000, and I talk about this in the book. It's when the back to the city revival, when sort of not just young people and the creative types, the artists, musicians, and the gay community headed back to great urban neighborhoods. It's really when more affluent and educated people in large numbers began returning to cities. And now that we have the research in, you know, now that we have the 2010 census and all of this, you can see that it really was that period. So I think for me, it probably became quite obvious around the year 2010 that something very dramatically had changed. And although the urban revival was in many ways a very good thing, you know, you want cities to come back, be vibrant, to have a attract the middle class. But around 2010 and thereafter, it became clear to me that I wanted to dig in and look at, you know, these kind of darker sides of the urban revival. And after 7 years of hard work, this book is the result.
I'm glad, you know, that Columbus is more populated downtown. There's grocery stores. There's, you know, all it's just completely changed from 20 years ago and 30 years ago when I first moved here. And I'm glad for it, but I can't really afford it, right?
You know, I know Columbus really well. I moved to this city in 1984. My first academic job was in the Department of City and Regional Planning at Ohio State University. And, you know, I had moved from New York City. I was a graduate student at Columbia. And I did not expect what I found then. I found Columbus. I lived in German Village, which to this day I still see as one of the most remarkable mm-hmm. Urban neighborhoods from a street design, housing, density. I mean, I just love that, the look and feel and nature of that neighborhood. And I remember the blooming of the Short North. I really mm-hmm. remember a buddy of mine had an art gallery there. I was there like the first night Kent Rigsby's now no longer their restaurant, but I remember that when that restaurant opened, and I saw the whole thing happen. But still, you know, if you look at Columbus, as you said, what's happened in the past two decades is really different. I mean, the Short North had the Short North Tavern and an art gallery, and then Rigsby's opened, and there was not much else around there. There was a bunch of vacant parking lots, to be quite honest. And this kind of boom in and around the Short North, in and around the downtown, is something that's happened recently. And I think, you know, I spoke to a reporter for the Dispatch who's done, in fact, I hope to meet with him later today. I think I will meet with him later today now that I'm back in Columbus at OSU. But he said to me, you know, how does Columbus stack up? And I said, Columbus is like Austin, only more. And I think even when I said it, he and I were both in shock that I said that. But, you know, so many people hold up Austin, college town, state capital. But I think in many ways with Ohio State with the knowledge-based institutions, with the great, you know, retail, innovative retail industry, with these great urban neighborhoods, Columbus is a magnet for talent, a magnet for knowledge in the so-called Midwest or so-called Rust Belt. And I think its achievements have been underestimated by many. So, yeah, I think it's been part of the urban revival, sharing in many of its benefits, but also many of its challenges.
Mm-hmm. More people want to go downtown for festivals and concerts. They want to eat down there. They want to enjoy the theater. I mean, really, when you go down there, you must have seen it. People are around after dark, which is very different from 30 years ago. But the idea is that the creative class is creating cities that don't work for everyone. So I can visit downtown. I lived in German Village, too, for a while when I first moved here, but I can't afford to live there anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's the nature of the new urban crisis. But first, before we dig into that, you know, I just want to give folks some background on how much this revival, you know, Columbus now has over 300,000 people who are members of the so-called, the group I named the creative class. Mm-hmm. You know, that's 34% of its workforce. That's very high. You know, I have indices of technology accumulation, talent, tolerance. You know, Columbus scores very, very well. And it's attracting venture capital. You know, I looked at this in my research. It's on par with Ann Arbor or Madison or other mm-hmm. great college towns. But I think, you know, as Columbus has become, and you think, I mean, I just want to give this other context. You know, when you look at other cities that I love, I love Cleveland. I lived in Pittsburgh for nearly 20 years, and Pittsburgh is now actually turning around. But, you know, Columbus and very few other places stand up. Toronto, where I live now, is another place in the so-called Rust Belt or Great Lakes that has achieved a knowledge economy. But it's a very rare thing indeed that a place in the Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan builds a knowledge economy. And I think that's a testimony to, you know, having great knowledge institutions like Ohio State and others, the hard work of building great neighborhoods. But yes, I think, as you said, the downside is that, you know, even before we get into housing costs, mm-hmm. If 34% of Columbus's labor force are members of the knowledge class, that means, you know, just doing the math, almost two-thirds are being left behind. And nearly half of Columbus's workforce are low-wage, low-paid retail workers, personal care workers, food preparation and service workers. And you know, while the knowledge workers can afford to live, you know, I've done the research in the book, while the knowledge workers, even after paying for the cost of high housing in the urban center, can make it work, they have about 60 or 70 grand left over, believe it or not. It's the service workers who end up with like 10 or 15 grand left over who are falling further and further behind and either pushed into very, very disadvantaged neighborhoods in and around the core or out into the far exurban fringe.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Richard Florida, head of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. Familiar with his name? His new book is entitled The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I guess the question is, you know, you talked about the rise of the creative class in your last book. No one did this to the cities, you know, whatever kind of inequality mm-hmm. is coming out of this. No one did it to them on purpose, right? But people who invest in cities must have known what the possible outcome would be when they increase the value.
You know, I don't want to say we were naive, but I don't think anyone, if we scrolled back, you know, the year 2000 or the year 1998, when I was doing the research for this book, you know, I think we were hopeful that cities would come back. You know, I talk about my boyhood. I was born in Newark in 1957. I saw that city engulfed in flames, in riots. I saw its downtown, which was thriving with department stores and retail shops, be abandoned. And, you know, I was a high school senior when New York declared fiscal insolvency or bankruptcy. You know, I went to Columbia University for a PhD, and I saw Soho and Greenwich Village, you know, emerge as hipster and bohemian, and artists and gay people rebuilt those neighborhoods. But, you know, when I talk to mayors today, I think we all agree, and urban leaders, we couldn't have hoped for this urban revival. I certainly couldn't have imagined. If you asked me 15 years ago, would Columbus look like this, or would Boston, or you get San Francisco, would high-tech companies be leaving their suburban Nerdistan, you know, out in the suburban office park, barreling into downtown urban zones where the artist occupied. You know, there's more venture capital startups in our urban cores today than there are in suburban office parks. There are two neighborhoods in downtown San Francisco which were burned out industrial zones, mm-hmm. which collect more than $1 billion each in venture capital-backed startups. It's stupefying when I even say this to myself, and I'm a supposed, as you kindly called, the urban expert. So I could not have anticipated it. But
you predicted it.
I was hopefully optimistic that it would occur, and I think it has accelerated in ways that have caused these deep and enduring problems of segregation and inequality. And I think many of us believed that our economy would, by its very nature, be more inclusive. I don't think we believe that our economy would divide. And you know, I talk in the book about moving to Toronto and seeing this kind of dysfunctional crack abusing mayor Rob Ford be elected, yeah. and how that reflected these divides of the people who were being left behind. And, you know, another thing is the rise of Trump and Trumpism and Trumpist populism really took me by surprise. So I think all of these things are a product of this new urban crisis. And for folks listening in, I think it's really easy to understand. It's the same clustering of talented people, of knowledge, of tech companies, of the affluent and the educated and the young, the same clustering that drives this innovative, knowledge-based great economy called Columbus. That same very clustering of economic assets and people also is what divides us, because as we cluster it, we drive up, as you said, we drive up housing prices. As housing and real estate prices get higher, only more affluent people can afford to live there. And then we get a society that is segmented, of course, along racial and other lines, but also along socioeconomic or class lines. And I think that's where we've ended up.
Because meanwhile, back at the ranch, you know, while things were re-jiggering, we didn't address a lot of social ills that are pervasive, that remain with us.
Well, this is even more daunting than that. So I moved to Toronto and we had a very left-leaning, progressive, social democratic mayor, David Miller. Obviously, Toronto, believe this or not, the median price of a detached home in Toronto was $1.7 million. Ken Livingston in London, a some people would call him Red Ken, a communist-leaning mayor. London now has amongst the highest housing prices in the world. I was with the former planning director to Mayor Williams in Washington, D.C. yesterday, and she was saying, we did affordable housing programs. We did pre-kindergarten education program. We had an inclusive economic development agenda, and Richard, nothing worked. And I think even for those cities and people who were aware of Bill de Blasio in New York City, now Sadiq Khan in London, mm-hmm. the forces of clustering, the power of this urban clustering, this draw to the city are so powerful that the things we've tried have not worked. So I guess what I'm saying is we have tried things. We've just not done them at the scale needed to address them. And then now, quite unfortunately, you know, with the most recent election, and even more so the political divide that we suffer from in America, it's unlikely that our federal government will ever again help the city. So in a way, our cities are left on their own, ill-equipped financially, ill-equipped fiscally, ill-equipped in terms of their own development to address this. So the book is kind of a clarion call to say these problems are getting worse. There is not going to be any on high. We as cities, mayors, urban leaders are going to have to figure out a way to address this ourselves. And the time to do that is now. But I think the big message is people have tried to address this. It's just what we've done have been not enough to stem the tide.
My guest is Richard Florida. His new book is entitled The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. The Provost Discovery Themes Lecture Program presents Richard Florida today, this afternoon at the Mershon Auditorium. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Well, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Downtown Columbus is looking better and better, but it's not necessarily getting better and better for everyone who wants to live there or must live there. It's getting expensive, too expensive for many of the people who work there, don't want to commute, and still want to sock away some money. Urban studies theorist Richard Florida says that the much-hoped-for urban revival has turned into a new kind of urban crisis, one that's hard on the suburbs, too. His new book is entitled The New Urban Crisis: How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. He joins us by phone. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So the suburbs are home, as you wrote, to the fastest-growing population of poor people in the country. How can that be?
Well, it's interesting, you know, as our urban cores have revived, we used to have a hole in the donut. You know, it used to be the city was where the poor people were located, and perhaps shunted off, lacking opportunity. And my teachers called that the hole in the donut, the poor city surrounded by affluent suburbs. What's happened over the past decade and a half, of course, is that as the cities have come back, as the affluent and the educated in ways, the top 10%, if you will, have moved back to cities, the bottom 10% have either been shunted into the still unrevived, still disadvantaged neighborhoods in the city, but because they're much larger, much poverty and economic dislocation and economic distress has been pushed out into the suburbs. And with it, crime and violence and drug addiction and all the problems we used to think of were urban problems. In fact, if you look at this election, it wasn't the swing states that were key. It were the swing areas. And those swing areas that really swung for Trump and populism were the economically distressed, economically declining suburbs. So in the book, I talk about this, but I say, you know, it's not that the cities are up and the suburbs are down. It's actually different. And I kind of suggest that these terms, city and suburb, don't really work for us anymore. They don't convey what we mean. What I suggest is that we're looking at these small areas of concentrated advantage, some like German Village or Victorian Village or in the city, some upscale suburbs.
Richard Florida? Okay, we just lost him. We will get him back. In the meantime, if you have Richard, we will get him back. And in the meantime, we'll take your questions. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page. Richard Florida is the guest today for the Provost Discovery Themes Lecture Program at Ohio State. He's talking about the new urban crisis this afternoon at Mershon Law Auditorium. For more information, you can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org or call us at 614-292-8513. We're working on that right now. Maybe once again, we're talking with Richard Florida, author of a new book. It's entitled The New Urban Crisis: How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. We'll get Richard Florida back right now. Hi, Richard, you there?
Yeah, apologies for that. Not sure what happened. But anyway, we were saying that one of the things that happened is the suburbs, you know, which were traditionally the places where the affluent lived. As the affluent and the educated, the top 10% have moved back to cities, poverty and economic distress has been pushed out into the suburbs. Poverty is growing faster. And in fact, there's more poverty in suburbs today in the aggregate than there are in cities. But one of the things is that the book says is these terms that we think of, the suburb and the city, no longer really help us the way they did. And I say in the book, what we really have is a patchwork, if you will, with areas of concentrated advantage in urban areas like German Village or mm-hmm. Short North or Victorian Village, and also stretching out to great suburbs, Upper Arlington and their equivalents in Columbus, but also areas of economic distress, much larger areas of economic distress, still concentrated in the city and still pushing out to the suburbs. That expresses itself differently. In New York, that pattern looks different than it does in Columbus, than it does in Los Angeles. But every place we have advantage in the city and suburb and poverty in the city and suburb. So it really is a new kind of urban geography and a new kind of regional problem we're dealing with. And I think it really is a patchwork of advantage and disadvantage really juxtaposed and living side by side.
Is a patchwork easier to manage than the haves and the have-nots completely separated by zip codes?
Well, I think when you had the equivalent of gated suburbs, when the rich could sequester themselves in these zones, didn't need to live in a city, didn't need to be proximate to economic opportunity, didn't want to be close to these restaurants and the hurly-burly of urban life, they could essentially zone poverty and distress out. But now, you know, if you live in a city, the problems of city life are with you. It's congested. There's traffic. There's diverse. There's still, even in the most richest zones of New York or San Francisco, there are still poor neighborhoods. There's still transit. There are still service workers. So I think the silver lining, if I might, is that the pressures of urban life then get expressed on local government. And that's why mayors around the country are having to deal with inequality. You know, I point out in the book, ironically, that inequality and segregation are highest in the most liberal cities, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Washington, Boston. The places with the most liberal political outlooks have the highest rate of inequality, segregation, new urban crisis. So mayors like de Blasio, mayors like Garcetti in Los Angeles, mayors like Sadiq Khan in London are forced to grapple with this really, you know, what de Blasio calls the tale of two cities. So I think in a way it forces us to deal with the urban, if we could ignore the old urban crisis because it was in cities where the rich people had abandoned, it's harder to ignore the new urban crisis. So in this way, it surfaces political problems and causes policies, perhaps causes people to entertain policies they might not otherwise have.
In Columbus, and I don't know if this is the case in the really, really big cities, but a lot of the people who are moving downtown are young people just starting out and older people who want to retire or have the money. They're empty nesters, I guess, is another way to put it. So they're not bringing with them the burdens of having to educate children either.
Well, I call this the barbell demography, you know, which has been characteristic of our city and our urban revival. You on the one hand have the young, the educated, the affluent, the Ohio State grad, you know, the grads who are coming for opportunity and typically, well, we're staying single longer. They want a great social life. They want great restaurants. They're smart enough to know they don't want to drive. They want to go out at night. They want to be around things. And then, of course, families with children, because our urban schools in the main are still struggling. Then families with children, I say you still see the strollers. You have the strollerville in mm-hmm. German Village and Victorian yeah. Village. But once the kid gets out of the stroller, you know, they head off to the suburbs for access to better schools. You know, so I think that is still what's happening in the United States. But one of the things is, you know, Columbus is in the grip of this. You know, I have my handy dandy statistics, and I look at all 350-plus metro areas across the country, and all metropolitan areas, they're 51 or 52 larger than a million. You know, on my index of income segregation, Columbus is fifth. Educational segregation, eighth. Segregation of rich people, you know, in their own clustered zones, urban and suburban. This is for the metro, not for the city.
Mm-hmm.
Eighth in the country. You know, so on my combined measure of segregation and inequality, that takes economic, not racial segregation and economic inequality, Columbus is second of all large metros. So you can see that Columbus, as it has recovered, as it's been a success story of the so-called Midwest, as it has a knowledge economy, as it has not suffered the intensity of the crisis of Detroit or Cleveland, still is suffering from this new urban crisis, even as its economy has, in a way, boomed compared to its peers. So in a way, Columbus's very success, if you will, has caused it to experience this new kind of crisis. And that's not just city. My statistics, and I want folks to understand this, are for the metropolitan level as a whole. So across Columbus's cities and suburbs, it does have a relatively high rate of inequality, a relatively high rate of segregation. And although your housing prices are more affordable than New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles, as you mentioned, they are unaffordable enough that people are being priced out. So I think it's time for Columbus to take a good hard look and say, what can we do? You know, we've had a certain success. What can we do to address this?
I have a couple of callers who want to get to the politics of this, and I want to get to those. But first, I want to bring up something else that you talk about, and that is how some of the most vibrant and innovative urban neighborhoods are turning into deadened trophy districts. And a lot of people are worried that that's what's going to happen to Victorian Village, the Short North, and so forth.
Well, you know, my mentor was the greatest urbanist of all time, the late Jane Jacobson. Jane and I became friends. She had moved from New York to Toronto. She's American from Scranton. And when I moved to Toronto, she was in her 80s. And we talked about this. This was a decade or so ago, maybe a little longer. And I was asking Jane, you know, what is happening in Soho now that the rich people are moving into New York and these in the old art galleries and artists are being pushed out? And she said, you know, Richard, when a place gets boring, even the rich people leave. And I will never forget that. She had such a way with words and phrasing. But basically, now this isn't endemic by any means, and the book talks about that. But in areas like the Upper East Side or parts of Soho and Tribeca now, the creative vibe that was there, the creative energy that was there is no longer there. Artists and musicians and middle-class people can no longer afford to live there. And in many of these neighborhoods, this is not yet the case in Columbus. It's now starting to happen in Toronto, where I live part of the year. But what's happening is that people buy these condominiums or townhomes, don't even live in them. You know, they buy them as a kind of another investment vehicle, like they're buying a gold bar or they're buying some kind of stock or bond. And they're saying, well, if I have a condominium or townhouse in New York or wherever it is, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Miami, you know, that's my investment. I don't live in it. I may come to visit it 1 or 2 weeks a year, but it's appreciating so fast. You know, I'm going to consider it an investment. So the dead zones, they almost become, I tell the story in the book. Every time I visit London, England, my driver, inevitably, cab driver, takes me by this building abutting Hyde Park, and it's a beautiful glass building, and he says, you know, those flats in that building go for 10 or 20 or 50 million pounds, but nobody lives there. The lights are always off because people have bought those not to live in as an investment. And I think where that's happening is something that's quite tragic because it drains the energy out of our great urban areas.
Lee in Columbus, you're on the air with Richard Florida. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Nice conversation. You know, if you consider people who are poor, oftentimes we hear that they're homeless. And one of the things that I think is a way to reduce their dignity is by calling them homeless. You know, if anything, they're shelterless. Because obviously, you know, we all live on the earth, so the earth is our home. That's our God-given right. And I think there's a lot of things in society that diminish the poor. And one of the ways I think we can mitigate this problem is we should have a parliamentary procedure like India, where we have at least a voice of the poor in our legislation. Because, you know, your show yesterday was talking about the millions that are going to be spent on the senatorial race here in Ohio. We don't have a person who, unfortunately, might be very intelligent, lives in poverty. They don't have a chance to run for Senate. They don't have the money. But we should have their voice heard, and they should have a legislative seat. Wouldn't you think? Thank you. I'll take a call for you.
Okay, Lee. Thanks a lot. What about that imbalance of political power, Richard Florida?
Well, I think a couple of things Lee said are very important. One is homelessness is like our decayed urban schools, a great tragedy of American life. Other societies deal with homelessness more effectively, whether that's Europe or Canada. We deinstitutionalize people and throw them out on the street. And you can see it in our cities. And it's just awful. And then we try to, you know, put them off the street because the affluent and the urbanite doesn't want to see that. So one, I think in the United States, our cities should redouble their efforts to deal with homelessness in an effective way, getting people into apartments, getting them the kind of job and labor market counseling they need. Secondly, as Lee said, we're missing all of the talent and creativity that comes from lower income, more disadvantaged people. I grew up the kid of a factory worker. My parents had hardly any money. I was born in Newark. The smartest kids I've ever met, I didn't meet at MIT or Columbia or Ohio State. I met in my neighborhood. They just didn't have the resources, as Lee say, and support to And finally, we disenfranchised the poor in this country. We set up all sorts of barriers, not just from them running for office, but to actually vote. So these are parts of the tragedy of modern American life, and they're getting worse. We're cutting funding. We're disenfranchising more people. And hopefully my book and my work is a wake-up call. One thing I will say, and, you know, if the national level looks pretty bleak, the local level is very much a cause for optimism. And I think one of the things we as Americans need to do is stop paying so much darn attention to this dysfunctional nation state and dysfunctional imperial presidency, whether our guy or our person is in or not, and really start saying, you know, we can make a difference at the local level. That's where we can really affect change. And that's where partisanship doesn't matter. You know, when I go to a town, I honestly cannot tell you when I meet a mayor if they're a Democrat or a Republican or something else.
Mm-hmm.
That tells me that there's a different dynamic at the local level. So whether it's homelessness or whether it's political involvement, I think the way increasingly to solve it, my big wake up is the way to solve it has got to be to work at the local level and not pay too much attention, because we're going to get depressed and anxious. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just going to be down in the dumps if we look too much at the national level. Focus on the local, where you can make a difference and where change is very much happening. And in many cases, in most cases, in a positive way.
Bob in Hamilton, you're on the air with Richard Florida. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hey, first of all, thanks, Ann and Richard. I think this is the topic that is most important for the future of our country. And I just would like to quickly say I appreciate everything that's been discussed. The progress, obviously, is difficult when, you know, simple example, healthcare becomes, you know, a wedge issue for the country. But I've watched through my life, whether it was Reagan coming in the 80s or, you know, Bush and now Trump, progress tends to be undermined as the political cycles come and go. But I think the biggest thing that the middle class should learn is not to be fooled into thinking that the poor are the problem. The only way the middle class can be secure is to make sure that the lower class is treated fairly and equally to everyone else, and then all ships rise with the rising tide. Mm. So I'll leave it at that, and please keep the discussion going, because this truly is our future at stake. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Richard Florida?
I think you're right on both counts. First of all, and quite tragically, the middle class is being undermined in our society. If the old urban crisis of the 60s and 70s was about the middle class flight from the city to the suburbs, today it's even worse, because our middle class, not only our middle class, but our middle class neighborhoods, like the neighborhood I was born into in Newark, the neighborhood I grew up into in a suburb in New Jersey of a working class factory working father, they're being completely eviscerated. In the year 1970, 66% of Americans, two-thirds of us, lived in middle-class neighborhoods. Now less than 40% do, and I'm sure when the new statistics come out, it'd probably be closer to a third. In 209 of 230 or 223 metros for which the Pew Research Center has collected data, the middle class has declined. This is a tragedy of American life, as our middle is sucked up and we divide into small groupings of the rich, maybe 10, 20, 30% of us, and 66% or more falling behind. The second part is that I think you're absolutely right. And this has been my hard, you know, I had to rewrite the book after the election. And this was my big, big, big realization. As much as I would love to imagine it, not much progress has been made at the national level for cities over the course of my life. I watched Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program. I watched Jimmy Carter. I watched President Clinton. And I watched President Obama. And if you think about it, in terms of rebuilding our cities at the federal level, it's been at best a level playing field. If not, there's been declining support. And I think he's right. That's been undermined. It's been up and down. But if you look at the local level, if you look at the urban revival, if you look at the policies and practices of mayors and urban leadership, it has been incredible. So I think the only way around this divide in our country, this is what he said, this up and down cycle back and forth, is to put our efforts at the local level. And I think if we do, then we can see great success. And, you know, over the past 15 years, if we've rebuilt our cities and attracted people in investment, over the next 10 years or two decades, we have to double down on exactly what the caller said, making sure that we can rebuild our poor, rebuild our low-income disadvantaged neighborhoods, and rebuild our middle class. And I think the only way forward on that is to do it at the local level.
We'll continue our conversation with Richard Florida. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about our urban centers, which have been getting a facelift and new, more prosperous residents in recent years, much to the delight of urban optimists and much to the chagrin of those who see a crisis on the horizon. That includes urban theorist Richard Florida. His new book is entitled The New Urban Crisis: How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. Richard, I wanted to go back to the issue of, you know, a big theme is the strength of local governments and how you believe power should return to the cities, because you don't think that it's going to happen at the national level. You know, in Ohio, state lawmakers continue to cut funding and political power to municipalities, forcing local officials to raise more money locally, which is tough to do, and limiting their ability to hike minimum wages locally or even ban guns in local public parks. I mean, they don't have the power that they used to even 10 years ago here.
So this is why I think local empowerment and so-called devolution of power is the only way out. We are in basically a quiet civil war in our country, and the Ohio is in a way a ground zero for this. Between, on the one hand, red America, which wants lower taxes to spend less, the more conservative, if you will, social policies, and which sees cities as going the wrong direction, and blue America, which wants to spend more, invest in transit, have higher minimum wages, have more gun control, have better gay rights. And you know, when a country is divided in half, neither side's winning, as the previous caller said. So this was my big wake-up call. You know, after the election, my wife woke up and said, a very depressing party we had, the Americans in Toronto election party. She said, you know, if we are this depressed because our candidate, Mrs. Clinton, lost, imagine, Richard, if Mrs. Clinton had won, the less advantaged groups, the more economically distressed groups that were very, you know, vehement Trump supporters, imagine how they would feel. And so we have to find a way to accommodate these two Americas. And the only way, and I wrote a piece for those listening, and I had a very strong nemesis, a brilliant man named Joel Kotkin, who was more arguing for a suburban way of life. I was arguing for an urban way of life. We actually emailed one another and said we should write something together. We wrote a piece for the Daily Beast basically saying this. It's not only more effective that our cities have more power. It's not only politically better that we have a local direct democracy. To heal our divide, we have to respect one another. And I think this is what's going on in Ohio. That's happening because people are scared. If we give the cities too much power, they're going to enact a way of life we don't like. But if we say to people, if you want to live one way of life, a more conservative way of life, and pay less taxes, go do that. Vote with your feet. But if you want to live in a bluer city with better transit and more amenities and better schools, you know, and better minimum wage, and they treat people better and are safer because there are no guns, you can do that. You're going to pay more. And I think that's our only way around it. And I think we have an opportunity for two reasons. One, because a grouping of people, thought leaders like myself on the left and the right, believe this is the way to go. You have people writing for The Nation, like Benjamin Barber, and people writing for the National Review on the right, like Yuval Levin, saying this is the way our country has to go. Secondly, because mayors can lead this. Mayors, Republican and Democrat, can say we can build our cities and our communities the way, give us the money. And thirdly, because the Republicans don't like the federal government. And because they say the federal government is too big. So hand the power, the taxing power, the revenue power, back to cities and to some degree to states, but morally to cities and communities, and let us figure out how we want to live. But I think the thing is that we have to respect one another. We can't say, and I think this is what the divide is. We're on each side, we're so scared that if somebody controls the state, or somebody controls the governorship, somebody controls the presidency, they're going to impose their life and their fiscal strategies on us. I think if we did this, we at least have a shot. And as far as I can see, to be quite honestly, we're neither side, the red or blue side, is going to win the war. All we can do at this point is try to accommodate and live with one another, and local control is the best way to do that.
When it comes to transit, little can occur at the city level the likes of Columbus without some federal fuel. Governor Kasich rejected about an $800 million grant for high-speed rail startup from the Obama administration, I don't know, like 6 or 7 years ago. Donald Trump has talked about an infrastructure proposal, but he doesn't talk about transit. That's a big issue for cities as they're growing, especially if you want to link all that patchwork together.
Wow, this is exactly what I say in the book, and we need high-speed rail to link our places together, the Columbus to Cleveland to Detroit to Toronto. You know, you think about why the New York, Boston, Washington area, 56 million people, it's the equivalent to the fourth largest economy in the world because they have transit and within the metros, and they have high, you know, the equivalent of sort of high-speed rail across them. We have to get with the program. And the problem is that you know, we're a divided country. So we have an urban group, the blue, that depends on the cities and wants to invest in them, and then a more suburban and rural group, the red, and think these things are inappropriate. So cities are going to have to do this. We're going to have to work with the private sector. We know that the private sector sees transit as an opportunity. In Florida, where I live part of the year, our governor also rejected Obama funding, but the private sector stepped up with cities and said they're going to build a high speed or a higher speed. It's not full high speed
right, rail right.
between these communities. So I think that's what we're going to have to do. And I wish, you know, in the book I say, I wish we had a different administration. I wish we had federal spending for cities. There are many things I could wish for, but I live in the real world. And the divide, it's not just the red, it's the divide that's hamstringing us. So we've got to do this on our own, and we've got to understand no one's going to do it for us, and we're going to have to build here. But here's my vision, folks. I'm only going to say this because the Democrats are the minority party, the Republicans. But the Republicans could have done this if they were. My vision for the future is that by 2018, certainly, the Democrats decide that they don't want to nominate a traditional run-of-the-mill senator. They're going to nominate a mayor or a governor. I'll pick John Hickenlooper, the great former mayor of Denver, current governor of Colorado, very independent-minded thinker, nonpartisan. And John Hickenlooper says, this Democratic candidate, that I want to run in a bipartisan platform. I'm going to take Mick Cornett. Mick Cornett's the Republican mayor of Oklahoma City, who is the chairperson of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We're going to run on a ticket that says this. We're going to give America back to you. We want to make America great. We've heard from you that you don't think the federal government, the Congress, is working. We're going to turn back power using this federalist instrument that our founders gave her. We're going to turn back power to you in the cities. We're going to give you the powers to tax and spend, and we're going to get out of your way. We're not going to dictate what you do economically. We're not going to dictate what you do socially and culturally. We're going to let you decide to build or not build your economy. You decide what you want to do on gun control and so on and so forth. I think that's a winning formula, and I think that's in sync with the times. If we can get to that conversation about how to hand control and power and revenue back to our cities and communities, I think we can put our country better back together again politically, socially, culturally, and hopefully on the right track for economic renaissance.
Do you think that Congress really wants to do that? I know it's controlled by not only Republicans, but very conservative Republicans who say they want, you know, even the likes of, you know, a Steve Bannon, chief advisor to the president, say they want to deconstruct the administrative government. Do you think they really want to do that?
Well, I think we have a very dysfunctional situation on our hands, you know, with the Trump administration. And that came out of a very unique electoral circumstance where people were dissatisfied with both candidates and dissatisfied with the federal government. I don't think Trump and Trumpism will be the norm. If it's there for 2 years or 4 years, we're going to get something else. And in this sense, I think the mayors have the clout. The mayors have the clout to go to the Congress and to go to our federal government and say, look, really, it's time to turn back power to the states and cities, and we can do this, and we can help you do this. So I'm guardedly optimistic, but I don't see any other way around it. I don't see with our current dysfunctional national government, this imperial presidency, where we hinge our future. I mean, isn't it amazing in a country of 300 million plus people, 350 metros, thousands of municipalities, that we hinge our future on one person? And if we pick the right one, it's great. If we pick the wrong one, oh, my God, it's catastrophe. We need a more decentralized system of government just to make sure that we work well as a country. So I think we're at the crisis point. You know, that's why I call it a new urban crisis, where all of this is up for at least conversation. And I think that's a conversation, and thank you for allowing us to have it on your show. I think that's a conversation we need to be having. I think it's a conversation that Americans would resonate with. And, you know, one candidate, one mayor as candidate, one person who gets this can make that case very effectively. And then it's up to the American people to decide.
Georgia in Columbus, you're on the air with Richard Florida. Hi, Georgia.
Yeah, good morning. I wanted to ask Mr. Florida if he thinks that community land trust might be one vehicle to undo some of the gentrification problems that cities have.
It's a really good question. I say in the book, the big problem in our society is what I call the land nexus, big word, or the paradox of land. We have so much land in this country and around the world, and we are competing for only 6% of our whole land in America is developed. And we're competing for a sliver of, you know, 0.00001% in our urban centers and where everybody wants to be. So it's a very interesting point. I've not looked into this in great detail, but the old idea of making land a public resource, not one where it's competed after and the highest bidder wins. I think it's a very intriguing idea. And one thing I would say is that it would allow the people who create value. One of the things is, you know, if artists, if young people, if musicians, if the gay community creates value in an urban neighborhood, that value is then, you know, transferred to those with wealth and affluence who can purchase that land. In the Highline Park in New York, a fantastic park, when it was built with private, mainly private philanthropic resources and little city money, it was developers who captured the value by building luxury towers adjacent to it. And the community got very little of that value. So I think putting land in public trust is one way. The other thing I think is we need a land value tax. We don't need a traditional property tax. We need a land value tax, which taxes you not on the value of structure, but on the value of land. And if you don't want to build things and leave surface parking lots in place, you get taxed at a very high rate. And if you build great things, you get taxed at a lower rate. And you can even include affordable development. So I think those are the things we need to do.
All right, Georgia, thanks for that call. And Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Yes, hi. I wonder if our guest would agree with this thought, that one of our problems in not having effective legislators is that we elect people who smile well and remember names very well and hire the best graduates of political science who know the psychology of voters. Instead, I think what we need is college courses in community planning who would find and help elect effective legislators.
Hmm. Well, I'm building a course right now, an online course on the city. You know, hopefully it will attract, and it's going to launch in June. It's going to hopefully attract thousands of people and more. So and we're building a school for cities at the University of Toronto. My colleagues are building digital online courses. So I agree, this is information that needs to get out to the public, but you're also right. One of my very good friends teaches at Cambridge University, the place that gave birth to Cambridge Analytica. And he's a leading psychologist of all of these things. And, you know, he was completely broken by the fact that so many of these tools that psychologists developed, basically to give better personality assessment and to help you better understand yourself, were being used for what he thought is very devious purposes. So there's a lot of concern about this, and I think rightly so.
All right, Mort, thanks a lot for that call. You're not encouraged by the election of Donald Trump, even though he's a big city guy. You think of yourself still as an optimist. Is it because of your faith in just the city structure or what?
I think, you know, the logic of history is really on our side here. I really believe that there are two things that will help us win. Now, there's a short game and a long game. And the short game in the near term is quite problematic. But in the long game, the long run, I think we're okay. And here's why. I think what's happening is that we're tapping and harnessing the creativity of our people. And more people are contributing to our economy. And that's growing and growing. But two, more and more of us are urbanizing. You know, half the world's population lives in urban areas. That's going to grow to 75 or 85%. So in the long sweep of history, this combination of creativity and urbanism will work to our favor. But in the meantime, we got some hard work ahead because that very logic is the thing that's displacing people, that's causing these divides, that's what's causing this backlash. And we have to work very, very hard to mitigate it and make sure that that's why I say we need to move from our current reality of winner-take-all urbanism to a more inclusive urbanism for all.
Richard Florida, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And folks, come on out to my talk at OSU a little later. I'm sure it'll be stimulating and provocative and time to meet in person. So thank you very much.
To learn more about that program, you can check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.